Blue Dot, Episode 15, The San Andreas Fault.
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem.
I'm Matt Schiltz, and today we're talking about the big one.
It's likely to strike the southern section of the San Andreas Fault, south of Los Angeles. That part has been described and characterized as locked and loaded. And that's been in the news a lot lately. But we've known about this for a long time. So we're going to talk to the experts about this. We're going to talk to Ken Hudnut, who is an expert on the characteristics of the fault in Southern California and Central California. And he'll tell us about what it would be like to be right there when the big one happens. And then we'll talk to Carol Prentice from the Menlo Park office of the United States Geological Survey about the northern section of the fault in the Bay Area. So, Matt, when I, you know, watch a NOVA program about earthquakes, and I've seen many over the years, there's always one person that stands out to me as a spokesperson from the United States Geological Survey, and that's Lucy Jones, and she just retired from the Caltech Pasadena office. She's really is the face of earthquake science for Southern California. And nationally, she was just on the Conan O'Brien show talking about it. And we're going to have the good fortune to talk to her about the effects of a big earthquake and what it would do to infrastructure here in California. When did you first get interested in earthquakes and seismology?
Actually, not to my senior year in college. I was a physics major, and I met a couple of geophysicists at a brunch in my dorm, and they were basically going, you know, physics is building bombs, and because this was 1970s, and you know, seismologists or geophysicists get to go play in the mountains and get paid for it, which sounds like a pretty good deal. So I checked it out, and once I took my first geology class, I was completely hooked.
What's the first memory you have of experiencing a pretty good size earthquake?
Actually, it's extremely early. I was 2 years old, living in Ventura, and I have looked. It was about a magnitude 5, a little more than 5, just offshore, so it was very near our house. And I was very young. I was 2 years old, and I can just remember my mom, who's a native Californian, sort of herding us into the hallway and sort of putting herself above all three of us kids to protect us if something were to fall. And a pretty definitive memory early in life.
Let's talk about the San Andreas Fault, especially in Southern California. Of course, recently the headlines have been coming out that it's locked and loaded and ready to roll. That came out from the Southern California Earthquake Center and Tom Jordan. We've known about this for quite a while, haven't we?
Oh, yeah. That's nothing new. He was speaking at the National Earthquake Conference and trying to make sure people really understood what the stakes were. So he was speaking definitively, and it seems to have been picked up. But it's not anything new. We've been studying this for a long time. Most of the stuff that he was quoting about the consequences of such an earthquake were from a study that I led back in we released it in 2008. It was called the Shakeout Scenario, and it was a comprehensive analysis of what would be the consequences of a big earthquake. And we then created the first shakeout drill to help people understand, you know, to sort of help communicate that information. And, of course, it's become popular, and it's now happening annually, but it began from that scenario. So it wasn't new information. It seems to people need reminders on a pretty regular basis.
Let's talk about that study and what we do know. What are we expecting? For our listeners, explain exactly what segment of the fault and where that is that is locked and has not moved in a long time.
Okay, so the San Andreas runs all the way from Cape Mendocino in Northern California down to the Salton Sea near the Mexican border. And so it's about 1,200 kilometers, a little over 800 miles. But there's a section in the middle that seems to not build up to big earthquakes. It has little earthquakes all the time. We call it the creeping section. The southern section, south of the creeping section, 550 kilometers from the middle of the state, pretty much, near Paso Robles, for those who know the area, down to close to the Mexican border. within that, the upper half of it, the part sort of north of Los Angeles, moved in 1857. The part to the east, south of San Bernardino, last moved somewhere around 1680. That's before we have any written records, and we're getting that from geologic records. So when we go and dig into the San Andreas and look how often it has earthquakes on average, we see it averages 100 to 150 years between earthquakes in all of these sections. And here to the east, now it's been over 300 years. So that section from the Mexican border basically to San Bernardino, just east of Palm Springs as it runs, and then through what's called the San Bernardino Mountains, that section is considered the most likely source of a big earthquake in the United States.
And how big are we expecting?
Well, it depends on how big a section moves at once. And that's actually, so the magnitude is defined by the length of the fault that moves in the earthquake. You can't have a magnitude 8 in Los Angeles because Los Angeles is not big enough. To be a magnitude 8, the fault needs to be 200 to 300 miles long. So if we start at the Salton Sea and it ruptures up to the San Bernardino Mountains, that's about a 7 to 7.5, depending exactly where it would stop. If it keeps on going through San Bernardino and makes it up, say, to near Palmdale, north of Los Angeles, then it would be a 7.8. And that's what we used in the shakeout model. There's really no reason particularly to stop it there. If it kept on going and goes all the way up to the creeping section, then it would be an 8.2. So, and the interesting thing, though, is the amount of damage from a 7.8 and the 8.2 is not very different. What's different is we're including more area. So there'd be more damage around Santa Barbara and in the western Central Valley. Those are not places with a lot of people, so the damage numbers don't go up by very much when you include that.
You're listening to Blue Dot, and we're talking about the San Andreas Fault System with Dr. Lucy Jones, seismologist. Let's talk about the effects of an event like that. What would we be looking at in Southern California as far as damage to infrastructure and, of course, casualties?
Okay, so if taking the 7.8, where we worked it out in great detail with a very strong shaking in the L.A. metropolitan area, we estimate 1,800 dead, 300,000 buildings damaged to the level of moderate damage, at least 10% the value of the building is lost, a total of over $200 billion in damages. Now, why do we have that level? One thing is that it triggers fires, and about half of the losses come from fires. It also disrupts our infrastructure. We expect to have, lose electric power, water, natural gas, sewers. All of them will have significant breaks. And then the question is how fast we can get them back online, which is all estimates. The estimates of the water are the longest. It'll take up to 6 months to replace all the pipes in the ground. The sewers probably similar. You basically, wherever you have water pipes, you have sewer pipes, and they tend to be built about the same, and they tend to break at the same time and therefore cross-contaminate, so requires replacing the whole system. The electric system, there's more debate about how long it'll be out, and there's some big unknowns that might control that. There are also, so there's the distribution system within the metropolitan area that gets the water and the power into your house, into your business. There's also the major transmission systems that bring them into the area. And all of those systems have to cross the San Andreas Fault to get to us. Now, what it means to have a magnitude 7.8 is that for 200 miles, one side moves with respect to the other a distance of 10 to 30 feet. So everything crossing the fault is offset by 10 to 30 feet. And that includes all of the freeways coming into the area, everything except for I-5 going down to San Diego and Highway 101 going north, but all of the ones going to the east and north get cut off. All of the railway lines coming into the area, all of the electrical transmission lines, all of the gas lines. And the gas lines, when they cross a fault like that, they get ripped apart, they're pressurized, rapid expansion of the pressurized gas, it explodes. And our pipeline expert said we were going to have a crater and huge fire set off in Cajon Pass. And that's an example of actually why we did the analysis. We can tell you exactly where that pipe is going to break. And one of the things we could do is we could go and require shutoff valves on either side of the fault so that when it does break, at least we don't have the big explosion and propagating fire. That has not happened yet. I would love to see it happen.
Real quick, what are some of the misconceptions people have about earthquakes? If you're living in Southern California or the Bay Area, your odds of surviving are pretty good, aren't they?
You are far more likely to die on the freeway. You're far more likely to be murdered than you are to die in an earthquake. 1,800 dead in our worst earthquake for over 100 years, divide 1,800 by 100, it's 18 people a year that we're talking about dying on average. So it's very unlikely that you're going to die. What is quite likely is that you'll be bankrupted by it. The chances that if you own a house in Southern California, that you're going to have major losses to, something close to more than half of your insured value of your house is greater than your chances of having a fire destroy your house. It's greater than your chances of totaling your car. So we sort of worry about the wrong things. We worry about dying and say, well, whatever the finances are, whatever they are. And I think that's actually, we need to change our perception of it, but I also think we need to change our policies. People say how, well, we build for earthquakes in California, right? We all have good buildings. Well, our building code says make sure you can crawl out alive, but if it's a total loss, well, that was your financial choice to make. And that's a very dangerous attitude, because when we damage the finances of 1 million people or 10 million people, the long-term depression and economic impact can be huge. And if you look back at the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, they lost. They were the premier city before that earthquake happened. The decade after that earthquake is the biggest growth decade in the history of Los Angeles. People gave up on San Francisco and came south. And now Los Angeles, before the earthquake, Los Angeles was one-fifth the size of San Francisco. Now it is five times the size of San Francisco. So you can say that there are financial impacts that can go on for decades.
Lucy, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Lucy Jones, one of the preeminent seismologists just newly retired from the USGS at Caltech Pasadena. And coming up next, we're going to be talking to Ken Hudnut. He is going to be taking over Lucy's old job, or just has. He's a science advisor for risk reduction at the USGS. And he's going to tell us about the character of the San Andreas Fault in Central and Southern California. I want to talk with you mostly about the fault and the geology of it, because we talked a lot with Lucy about the effects. Can you tell us a little bit about the character of the San Andreas Fault from middle, central California south to the Salton Sea?
Yeah, sure. So from Parkfield, which is at the southeast end of the creeping section, we can pick it up there. And from that point, it goes down through what's called the Carrizo Plain, which is at some times of year just beautiful with wild flowers, but a lot of other times of year it's just a real dry place with not many people live out there. So the San Andreas Fault goes cutting through the topography out there. When you fly over it, most people fly over it between San Francisco and L.A., people may be able to recognize it. It looks like a scar in the surface of the ground out in the Carrizo Plain. And probably the single most spectacular feature along the San Andreas Fault is out there. It's called Wallace Creek. It's named after a USGS geologist, Bob Wallace, who studied the San Andreas Fault. And this is a place where Kerry C., who was a famous paleoseismologist from here at Caltech, he measured the San Andreas Fault slip rate at that location. He used the offset of that old dry stream channel, radiocarbon dated it, and just simply divided the offset of the channel by the radiocarbon date to get the fault slip rate. And ever since then, we've known that the San Andreas took up about 35 millimeters a year of plate motion between the North American and Pacific plates. So that was a classic study right there. Well, so coming down out of the Carrizo Plain, you then go through what's called the Big Bend, where the San Andreas Fault gets a little bit crosswise with the plate tectonic motion. So there's compression, and that's why we have the transverse ranges, the mountains that are here to the north of Los Angeles.
That's the Grapevine region.
Yep, from the Grapevine right on down to Cajon Pass and even all the way down to Whitewater, which is closer to Palm Springs, where all the windmills are. So that whole part of the San Andreas Fault is kind of misoriented, and because of that you have compression and mountain belting. The mountain building is responsible for the big earthquakes in 1971 and 1994 that hit in Los Angeles in the San Fernando Valley. So that's that compression and the Big Bend. Now, as you continue southeast from Whitewater and Palm Springs area down to the Salton Sea, that's called the Coachella Valley section. The orientation is just right for strike-slip movement on the plate boundary down there. The thing is that that part of the fault has not had a big earthquake since about 1680. So the radiocarbon dating paleoseismic work down there by Tom Fumall and others showed that that section of the fault typically has a big earthquake about once every 150 years, but it's been more than 300 years since the last big one. So bad news for people, right? So that's the part that we consider, in Tom Jordan's words, locked and loaded. He's been saying that for a long time.
We're about out of time, Ken, but I did want to ask you one question. We're talking to Ken Hudnut, who's a USGS seismologist from Pasadena. Describe for me, what would it be like if you were at the fault right there during a rupture that's a magnitude something 7.8 or larger? What would we experience? And if we could perhaps have a drone hovering over it with a HD camera that could capture images of this, what would we see? What would we experience if we were right there on part of the fault that was breaking like this?
Well, first you would feel a sharp jolt as the P wave came underneath you. And then off in the distance, you'd see the fault rupture coming right towards your location. So you'd see a crack forming in the surface of the ground, and you'd see offset across that crack. And then just as the crack arrives at your location and goes roaring past you down the fault, you'd also feel the shear waves arrive, and those are the big damaging waves. So it'd be quite an experience, I'll tell you. And so if you were happened to be at a place where there was a road or a fence crossing the fault and perpendicular to it, you would see that offset to the right relative to where you're standing by anywhere from a few feet to as much as 20 or so feet to the right. And so that would be part of the experience, too, is that the fault rupture would occur and you'd witness that. We've actually had a few people witness fault rupture, and I've interviewed a couple of them, and it's quite an experience. We had one woman in China was knocked down, and she didn't get to see the rupture go by, but when she got back up, she saw it in front of her. Another gentleman down in Mexico saw the rupture go by and described it as a race car going past with a big plume of dust going up, shooting out of the ground behind it. So anyway, I've thought about that, and I hope to experience and see that someday. I guess we'll see. Maybe I'll be in the right place at the right time to see it. But it'd be actually a relatively safe place to experience and witness a rupture. It would be to be right out there along the fault because there's no building to collapse on top of you.
Yeah, the fault doesn't kill you. It's the buildings that do.
That's right.
And how fast would that happen, that offset? How quickly would you see that? What kind of speed would we be talking for a 20-foot offset?
It would happen within just a matter of probably less than a second as the rupture went roaring past you at a speed. The crack tip would be speeding along at around a few kilometers per second. So when we talk about that big San Andreas earthquake, if it's, say, a 300-kilometer-long rupture, it would take about 100 seconds for the rupture to go from the southeast end to the northwest end, for example. So a minute and a half for the rupture to occur. But if you're just standing at one place and watching it come at you and then go all the way to the other horizon, it'd just go right on by at a speed of several kilometers per second.
Well, I imagine that would be a lot of people's nightmare, but for a seismologist's dream.
Right, yeah. It's it's exciting to study earthquakes. It's a great field, and I think the reason I like it most of all is that it gives us an opportunity to do science that actually matters for people, you know, and it's a way to do something that's societally relevant. And so our challenge is to communicate about the science that we're doing and explain to people the impact that it has, and there are just so many ways that that's true. But especially when you study something like natural hazards, volcanic eruptions, landslides, or earthquakes, there's that direct connection to what matters to people.
Ken, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Ken Hudnut, Science Advisor for Risk Reduction at USGS Pasadena. You're listening to Blue Dot, and we're talking about the San Andreas Fault System. When we come back, we'll be talking to Carol Prentice from USGS Menlo Park about the northern part of the fault. And we're back, and we're going to talk now to Carol Prentice. She's a research scientist from the USGS Menlo Park office. I'd like to ask you about, we're talking about the San Andreas Fault. It's not really just one fault. It's really a system, isn't it? Could you describe it in those terms for us?
Well, so there's two things to consider. There is a San Andreas Fault, and there's also a San Andreas Fault system. So the system is really the set of faults that take up the horizontal motion between the North American and the Pacific plates. That plate motion, the majority of it is taken up along the San Andreas, or at least the San Andreas takes up more than any other fault. But in places such as the Bay Area and also down in Southern California near Los Angeles, there's not just one fault that's taking up that plate motion. There's a whole system of faults. The San Andreas is the largest, longest, kind of most important of those faults, but all of them contribute to taking up the total plate boundary slip.
Well, let's talk about one of the faults in that system in the Bay Area, and I think one that's of major concern to scientists, and that's the Hayward Fault. When was the last large rupture along that fault?
1868.
And how big was that event?
Well, that's not terribly well known. It was probably in the sevens.
And so,
in 1868, there weren't any seismographs in California. So we don't have a lot of information. We do have a lot of descriptions of the ground shaking. So we know something about it historically.
Mark Twain famously wrote about it.
Could
you tell us, for our listeners, give us a sense of the geography of where the Hayward Fault lies?
So if you imagine the Bay Area, San Francisco sits on a peninsula, and then to the east there's the San Francisco Bay. The Hayward Fault actually runs up the East Bay, so it runs through Berkeley, Oakland, Hayward, cities in the East Bay.
And how frequently has that fault broken in the past?
So it's known from geologic studies and a particular kind of geologic study called paleoseismology that earthquake has had big ruptures on average every 160 years for the last 2,000 years.
If there was a magnitude 7 or so earthquake on the Hayward Fault, what kind of an event are we looking at there as far as compare that to the damages from Loma Prieta in 1989?
So when there's a large earthquake on the Hayward Fault?
Yes.
It all depends really on how prepared we are. We know the fault is there. We know it runs through the a highly populated urban corridor. We've been getting better and better and better prepared. However, if it were to happen today, you know, we do expect a great deal of damage. There are a number of structures that are built on the fault, and the ground shaking will be very strong.
And of course, famously, the fault goes right through Cal's stadium.
Right, that's right.
In the event of a Hayward earthquake, when that happens, that crosses a lot of infrastructure, doesn't it?
It does, and many organizations have become aware of that and are addressing that problem. For example, our water that comes from the Hetch Hetchy, it's an amazing engineering feat, you know, to bring water from the Sierras to San Francisco. That system has to cross all of the faults in order to get to the reservoirs, including the San Andreas. The San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, which operates that system, has been doing a lot of work to retrofit the fault crossings of its infrastructure. So I think that they're in a much better position today. And as time goes on, you know, things do get better and better in terms of awareness and actually doing something to mitigate the damage.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions that people have about faults and earthquakes in general?
I'd say that the misconception I run into most commonly in the Bay Area is this idea that, well, you know, I made it through the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. Everything was fine. My house was fine. My family was fine. Therefore, I'm okay. I don't really have to worry too much about earthquakes. And the reason that's such a big misconception is because that earthquake wasn't all that big. It was a big earthquake, but it wasn't as big as what we expect will happen eventually. It also was pretty far away from really the densely populated part of San Francisco. And we do know that earthquakes are going to occur that are much closer to the population centers and that are much larger. So that attitude of, I made it through Loma Prieta, I'm all right, that's not really true. You really have to take stock of what's possible and what your situation is and get ready for a much bigger earthquake that might be closer to you.
Carol, thanks for spending time with us today. Enjoyed talking to you.
Okay. Thanks very much.
We want to thank our guests, Dr. Lucy Jones, USGS scientist retired from the Caltech Pasadena office, and Dr. Ken Hudnut, also based in Pasadena, as well as Carol Prentice from the USGS office in Menlo Park. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. And as always, I remind you that from deep space, we all live on a sometimes shaky pale blue dot.